Good morning. Good morning, Washington, D.C. Chris Garlock sitting in for Bill Fletcher today. We're going to talk about free speech in the nation's capital. 202-588-0893. Since we'll be talking about free speech, we want to hear what you have to say about it. My guest this hour, John Boardman, Executive Secretary Treasurer of Unite Here Local 25, and Mara Verheiden-Hilliard. She's the Executive Director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Let me start, well, first of all, welcome to both of you. Thanks for being on.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, I've got you both on. It's free speech as a general topic, but there's sort of two different pieces to the same problem. John, let me have you start with this Amplified Noise Amendment Act of 2018, which there was a hearing at City Council yesterday, right?
That's correct.
I love the way these guys title things. I think we're calling it the noise bill, right?
Yeah, that's generally what the term. which is unfortunate because free speech generally is not noise. So.
Thank you. I guess it's noise if you don't like what's being said, right?
Content is always seems to be the issue, yes.
Well, so what's, and I know we have been talking about, we meaning those of us in the labor movement, have been sort of seeing this coming and popping up from time to time for quite a few years now. This is sort of the latest iteration, right?
That's correct, Chris. This for Local 25 and for a lot of us, this goes back to 1981 when Local 25 sued the city and got an injunction against what was found to be an unconstitutionally restrictive noise ordinance. And over the years, there have been various attempts to curtail free speech activity. We think that this is the latest attempt to do so.
Well, and I want to get. I do kind of want to dig into this. I mean, what's the idea? Sort of sketch the overall problem. I mean, I have been on plenty of picket lines with you guys over the years.
You have.
But the whole point there is to make it uncomfortable for the employer, so that they will either come to the table or do the right thing or whatever. And that is very clearly free speech. In fact, John, a lot of times, I'll get a call from a local who will want to know, what permit they need to get. And I'm like, it's free speech, guys. You don't need a permit.
Well, and that's candidly part of the problem. If I could set the table a little bit, Chris.
Sure.
This thing arises now out of, frankly, a changing downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And arises out of a court case involving a busker at a metro stop. And what's really driving it on the local level is downtown residents and businesses trying to restrict the sound that is emitted by amplified activities from buskers. And in that case, and let me kind of sum up what the changes are. Right now, under the current law, restrictions on amplified free speech are limited to residential zoning and are enforced through DCRA and other regulatory agencies, and that's important, using scientific measurement criteria to make a determination whether a violation exists. The proposed changes move to what's called an audible distance standard with enforcement by the police. So what does that mean? That means that if you can be heard by a cop 100 feet from the source of the sound, that cop can come over, give you a warning, and if you don't back it down, they can shut you down, seize your equipment, and give you a fine and potential criminal violation.
Wow.
So it is a very, very drastic proposal, and this is driven, as I say, by residents and businesses, largely in two, possibly three locations in the city near metro stops. So what we have is the city council going after a problem with a sledgehammer as opposed to a scalpel.
Well, we can have a conversation about the city council and their choice of tools. I know you spent a lot of time down there this week. Let me bring in Mara because this issue of police or law enforcement officers determining things sort of segues into what I guess we're calling pay to protest, which honestly, when I first heard about this, Mara, I thought it was a pretty bad joke, but it's pretty serious, right?
Yes, and, the idea, just when you say pay to protest, the idea that the government is going to essentially tax demonstrators for their access to public space seems so ludicrous and outrageous that you would think it wouldn't even be contemplated. But in fact, the Department of Interior and the National Park Service have put out proposed rulemaking that includes substantial changes, really overturning 50 years of constitutional rights litigation that has forged the permitting system in the nation's capital for major public spaces under federal jurisdiction. And among the proposals they've put out is this idea that they are going to tax demonstrators, that they're going to charge demonstrators fees and costs for their access to public space. These fees and costs can include, in addition to application fees, permit application fees, could include the costs of the personnel, the Park Service personnel that they'll send out to monitor a demonstration, including an overtime, could include barricades and fencing put up at the discretion of the police. You know, they're going to pen in a protest and charge you to do it, even if you don't want it. They can include costs after the fact of what they call harm to turf. In other words, that when you have an assembly and you have a demonstration and you have it in our green spaces and you stand on the grass, they'll come back and decide that you've harmed the grass by standing on it and charge you a bill for it. So these kind of rules could actually have a potentially bankrupting impact on grassroots organizations and would make it impossible for any group to go forward with the threat of these expenses hanging over them.
202-588-0893. Chris Garlick here talking with John Boardman, Mara Hayden-Hilliard about free speech in the nation's capital. Mara, I have gotten so many permits over the years, and you have to know which agency to deal with. I had to learn that, those little pocket parks that look like little neighborhood parks are often actually run by the Park Service. So I have to say, the Park Service was always one of the easiest to deal with, very professional. God forbid you had to deal with it. As John knows, dealing with the D.C. cops is it depends who it is, frankly, the guy on the ground. But one of the things that I always loved about the Park Service was that, you apply for a permit, and if they don't deny it, I think it's in 48 hours, you just have it. And that, at least in all the years I've been doing, which is, I think, 15 years now, I don't think we've ever been denied a permit. They want to change that, right?
They do, and that's just the thing. Like what you're describing, for any of us here who have gone through the permitting system and worked with groups going through the permitting system, there is a system. It is a first-come, first-served system.
Mm-hmm.
If someone else doesn't already have a permit in for the space and such that it wouldn't allow for dual use of that space, you have the right to use it. It's very simple. There's no content that goes into the determinations. It's just we have our public lands. They're ours to use, and basically the Park Service manages those lands sort of, more like a traffic cop. That's what it's supposed to be. And what they want to do is throw that whole system out the window. Among the changes that they're proposing is what you're describing as the elimination of the 24-hour deemed granted rule. And the rule has always been, since the 70s, that when you put in for a permit application, if the Park Service has not denied your permit within 24 hours, you may accept it as deemed granted, move forward, begin organizing your demonstration, tell people that they can come, start organizing people to come, knowing that you have that space, start, contracting with vendors if you're having a large event that requires stage and sound, doing all the things you need to do. While you may continue to have discussions with the Park Service to nail down final logistics, you know that you have the space and you know you have a deemed granted permit. They have proposed tossing that out the window, that they're going to eliminate the deem-granted rule, and instead they're going to create this structure that has no hard deadline for the Park Service to ever tell anyone that their permit is granted or denied. And at the same time, they're changing the processing system entirely where demonstrations, you know, always ran on their own track. Demonstrations are different than special events or commercial filming where
right.
you have corporate-sponsored entities who are using the public space or like the multi-million dollar Wonder Woman blockbuster enterprise that was here over the summer. That's very different than free speech activities. Now what the Park Service wants to do is lump all of them together into one bucket called events, and then if you're saying that your event is a demonstration, they're going to have a government official go through your activity and make decisions about whether they think pieces of your First Amendment activity contain what they call special event elements, in which case then they will start assessing charges and they will process it differently as well. So what are special event elements? Well, apparently that also includes like cultural and musical performances. So you could have a major rally, you know, against a war, an anti-war rally, an immigrant rights rally, a labor rights rally, anything. And if you have a musician who comes to play in solidarity, suddenly this becomes a special event element.
I can see. So what problem is this solving?
And it's solving no problem. And that goes also to the heart of the illegality just from a technical standpoint of what they're doing. When an agency wants to promulgate new rules, the rulemaking needs to, one, be addressing a problem. They have to identify a problem that they need to fix, and then they have to show how the rules effectively do address that problem. They've done neither of those things with any of the major changes, and there's many changes in this proposed rulemaking. And the single problem that they keep identifying, for example, when it comes to costs, is they talk about the expense and the burden on them from handling events. And then they conflate special events and demonstration activities. By their own numbers, and these are their own numbers, the annual number of permit applications they get for demonstrations is less than 20%,
right,
which makes more than 80% special events in commercial filming. If they believe that they aren't doing sufficient cost recovery against special events in commercial filming, they really should, because our taxpayer money should not be going to subsidize these corporate for-profit ventures. On the other hand, demonstration activity is part and parcel of the National Park Service's mission. That is what they're supposed to do, is facilitate the public's use of the public land. And the fact that they look at it and present it as if it's some outside external burden and cost really says everything about the attitude of this Department of Interior and the National Park Service under it.
So, you know, I've been accused of being paranoid and I'll own a bit of that.
Doesn't mean you're wrong.
That's right. Thank you, John Boardman. But, I mean, you know, again, the Park Service, you know, again, for 15 years, and you guys have been dealing with it for longer than that. I mean, does this come out did Donald Trump tell the Park Service, which screwed up the numbers on the the Women's March? I mean, did he say, you know, to do this? I mean, I just don't understand why the Park Service, which has always been fairly reasonable, would put the amount of time and energy into coming up with solving a problem that doesn't exist. Can somebody help me out on this?
Well, I think there's a couple of things in play. I mean, obviously, you have Ryan Zinke, who's the Secretary of the Interior, no
mm-hmm.
friend to protests and demonstrations. I mean, you know, if there was an opportunity to, drill on the National Mall, or
deforest. Don't give them ideas, Mara. Come on.
I'm sure they'd be right there for it. But the other thing is, in fact, you know, for people who are interfacing with the permitting office and the park rangers there, that's very different than sort of the overarching attitude of the National Park Service, more high-ranking officials. And all these permitting rules that, you know, they have some defects at points in time, but the system functions, as you know, and it's been functioning. Those have been put in place because, in fact, over five decades, the Park Service has not been reasonable about handling public space, and the courts have had to order them time
mm-hmm.
and again
mm-hmm.
to change how they handle things. Like the 24-hour rule, that was put in place by an order of the Circuit Court, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, back in the 70s, because the Park Service was constantly delaying acting on permits and disrupting the ability of people to organize. So many of the measures that we count on at this point came about because people had to go to court and force the Park Service to operate in a constitutionally acceptable manner.
Let me get John Boardman back in, because I know Local 25 is working on both of these issues. So connect them for me, if you would, John Boardman.
Well, I think it's the same theme through both sets of circumstances, Chris. Here on the local level, let me just sort of put it in context.
Mm-hmm.
Many of your listeners have been on picket lines. Many of those picket lines, and probably most of them, have been doing what a picket line is supposed to do, and that's using free speech to be heard. Being on a picket line and shuffling silently doesn't necessarily deliver the message to guests going into a hotel or to patrons of a business.
We've done silent vigils from time to time, but you know.
Well, that's a different tactic, and is certainly appropriate in those tactical situations. But for example, when I'm thinking now of when CWA went out against Verizon.
Oh yeah.
And down on I believe it was at the F Street location. Picketers were out there all day, every day, with bullhorns, letting the public know what Verizon was doing to undermine those contract negotiations. Under the current law, that was permissible. Under the proposed law, if a cop gets a call and stands 100 feet from that location and can simply hear what those picketers are saying through the bullhorn, he then notifies them that they must turn it down. If they fail to do so, he can seize the bullhorn, issue pretty onerous fines and potential criminal violations. Now, that's in our world. That's in our world. Let me give you another recent example, something that would relate to protests that took place outside the Trump Hotel during, and it's still going on, but during the protests for children being held in cages. A small group of about five or six people went down there with a stationary, small, amplified sound equipment and started reading off the accusations against the administration for these outrageous behaviors. That would be completely eliminate under this proposed legislation. Again, all that hotel would need to do would be to phone MPD, the cops show up, stand 100 feet away from that stationary amplification equipment, and if they can hear it, they can shut it down.
Let me jump in because, you know, again, I've just been, I often tell colleagues across the country, and we do more demonstrations in D.C. in a week than most people do in a year. And so we have lots and lots of experience. And the last person that you want to have interpreting rules, because they don't usually know them, and if they know them, they don't know them well, is the cop on the street. Honestly, you guys know this, right? I mean, that just seems like a recipe for disaster. I mean, I remember, John, I forget which demo it was, but we had thousands of people. We're at the front. We had worked out the route, you know, had a permit, actually, unusually for us. We had a permit, and we were supposed to go left, and the cop says, no, we're going right. You know, so we did what the cop said, but, I mean, it didn't matter. We had the permit. We showed him on the permit we were supposed to go left, and the cop said, go right. I mean, I don't really want to put that in the hands of the cop on the street, right?
And you couldn't be more right. I mean, it's, just to jump in on that, I mean, it is so dangerous to be putting this kind of discretionary authority in the hands of the police. And, you know, the noise law that John's talking about, the Noise Act effort, I mean, it's transforming also from, you know, what John's described as a science-based determination really into a complaint-based system.
Mm-hmm.
So the time that people are going to be shut down is going to be, certainly when it comes to issues of free speech, is going to be when somebody doesn't like the content of the speech and they're calling the cops. And that is when the cops are going to be acting against demonstrators and acting against protesters. And it also gives them so much discretion. Anytime that you put discretion in the hands of law enforcement authority, then you're setting up a situation for just, it's a proxy for content-based determinations. And it's really, really dangerous. You have to have hard and fast criteria. You have to have absolute rules. In the absence of that, you have an unconstitutional system. And I think the other thing that's coming into play too, a couple other, you know, issues with regard to the efforts of this D.C. noise law. I mean, it's a gentrification issue because, as John was discussing, we have different rules depending on the residential areas or where people are. But it's very popular to build these very expensive condos in downtown Washington. And it's like moving from the suburbs to New York City and then complaining that there is a lot of sound outside.
Hello.
And that's what's happening here. But then this also becomes a very valuable opportunity for those who want to shut down labor pickets. That has been an effort decade after decade in Washington that Local 25 and others have had to fight back against. And now we're seeing that come around again and coming through this means.
Well, and John, I want to get you in because I what I don't understand is what was wrong with the science-based one? I mean, even I think there were issues even with that, right? But, I mean, why would they toss that in favor of this 100-foot thing, which just seems nuts to me?
Well, there are two issues. One, which Mara just very eloquently stated, and that's the issue of gentrification and the changing population in the downtown core. That's one. But there's also the matter of whether there is political will to budget and train and empower regulatory agencies to do this and other things which regulatory agencies do. The current law, Chris, requires scientific measurement of the sound. And as Mara notes, if you're doing that, you're actually doing something other than listening to the content and figuring out whether you want to shut it down or not. If you, as a practical matter, if you have a threshold of decibels over which you go, that is a black and white determinative of whether you've got a violation of the regulation or not. If you've got somebody that simply walks 100 feet, doesn't like the content and can hear it, or likes the content and can hear it and lets the noise continue, those are things which are unacceptable on their face. We are arguing that we have, over the course of more than 30 years, and let me also acknowledge the Partnership for Civil Justice's work with us on a local level to craft these laws, we have over the course of 30 years put together what is admittedly compromised legislation so that people who wish to exercise their right to speak and be heard can do so in a manner that protects residential neighborhoods so that they do not have to endure what might be found in commercial zones. And we think that those laws are good and sufficient, provided that the government sees fit to budget and fund the enforcement arm, which they are currently not doing. We have no designated engineers to do sound measurements in this city. If you go to Philadelphia, they have 4 full-time engineers, 2 part-time engineers. They regularly take sound measurements and enforce the law up there. We're wondering why, if Philly can do it, why the nation's capital can't accomplish something like that here.
That's a really good question. Mara, and again, you know, you guys have been fighting on this for years, have been really, really solid. And I guess one of the things that I think about, there's the level at which, you know, you're fighting it. It's probably pretty clearly unconstitutional, but, there's the fighting it out in the regulatory, the fighting it out city council, fighting it out constitutionally. But then there's just the stuff down on the ground, right? I mean, that's what I worry about.
Yeah, I mean, there's as you're exactly saying, there are so many different levels at which these types of efforts to repress free speech manifest and get fought. And, you know, we can look at the letter of legislation and recognize where it's going to give too much discretion to law enforcement authority to act unconstitutionally. And then there's, you know, what you were describing earlier, which is you can have the law clearly written. You can have a permit in your hand. You can be on the ground mm-hmm. doing something, and you can have somebody with, you know, a club and a gun tell you that you can't do it. And, you know, you can hand them the permit. And, you know, we've had a lot of folks over the years, and I've been engaged in those, you know, instances on the ground physically myself with police where I'm intervening and saying, no, actually, these folks can go this way, and, you know, having to go through that. And this, you know, this happens over and over again. And it also really says a lot, too, about what we experience in society with regard to respect for free speech and whether a society cherishes those rights. And that's something that I think we're really seeing more and more with not just the Noise Act in D.C., but there's anti-protest legislation that's happening all over the United States where state legislatures are introducing bills that are directly targeted to shut down peaceful, nonviolent protest by increasing penalties for what used to be minor misdemeanors, turning them into felonies, by having fines that could mount to, you know, more than $1 million against organizers or people affiliating with organizers. A lot of these bills are, virtually all of these bills, are being funded really through corporate interests, through the fossil fuel, through pipeline industries. So there's really a concerted effort to attack and diminish the capacity of people to be able to demonstrate in the United States. And so we're seeing it on a national level. We're seeing it on a local level. And it's also this sort of overall consciousness, like the idea that when people are demonstrating, and as you both were talking about at the beginning, when you're in the street and you are making noise, the point is that you are supposed to be raising your voice. You are supposed to be making noise. You are supposed to be attracting the attention of other people who will say, oh, wait, I hear what they're talking about. This is an important issue. Maybe I want to join the march with them, or maybe I want to take a leaflet, or maybe I want to look twice at, you know, some employer that's engaged in wage theft. And, you know, all of these are important means to communicate to society, to communicate to the government. But instead, there's this effort to turn around and say that there's something bad about that, mm-hmm. that it's disruptive and that disruption is bad. And similarly, the National Park Service, the way that it's put out this new proposal for its massive regulatory overhaul, they talk about our green spaces and our grass as if they are ornamental, as if these are these manicured lawns and they are the wealthy landowners and they are letting us walk on them and we can't harm the grass, when instead our public green spaces, our sidewalks, and our streets belong to the people for use by the people for First Amendment activities. They don't belong to the government to dole out to us. And that's what we, as people in the United States, as people in Washington, D.C., that's what we have to reclaim and fight back. We have to say, actually, the streets and the sidewalks and the parkland are primarily for our use, and our ability to shout, to make noise, to picket, that is a critical part of democratic action in America, and one that any council person or anyone else voting against should be, ashamed, ridiculed, and shut down for doing that.
Well, it's one of our chants. Whose streets? Our streets. But apparently some folks have some different ideas. All right, we're talking free speech in the nation's capital. That's Mara Hyden-Hilliard from the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, and also John Boardman from Unite Here Local 25. We're going to take a quick break, come back with more conversation on that and your calls. I'm talking to you, Ali. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. All right, Arise. Chris Garlock, Bill Fletcher is traveling. We're talking free speech in the nation's capital, attempts to squelch it, to shut us down. As we were talking about just before the break, one of our favorite chants, Whose Streets, Our Streets. And we're talking John Boardman, been out there on plenty of picket lines from Unite Here Local 25. And Mara Hyden-Hilliard from the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, which has been fighting for a long, long time to preserve these rights. Ali, you are on a ride. Thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
Hello?
Go ahead, Ali.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was at the hearing yesterday, and, I have to speak from from my perspective, as somebody who has been in Washington, D.C. his whole life, like I said yesterday, I'm a third-generation D.C. native. And, you know, the gentrification issue is primary, is at the top of the list when it comes to what this is all about. You know, even if it's enforced, the enforcement, I heard the discussion on discretion. Of course they're going to begin to target the black people that are basically put homeless, you know. So we've raised the prices on everything that you used to own. And I also went to a seminar where they talked about the gentrification issue. The houses that the black people lost are basically went to these newcomers. So all of this is being orchestrated, and they don't want anybody to interfere with what they're planning. I mean, it is a black and white issue. But, I mean, I see other people are getting involved because it affects them. You know, you can't hurt one group of people and think that it's not going to come and bite you at the end of the day. So black people have lost property, work, their taxes, bases for almost 100 years in this city. And they have no intention on stopping, you know. And there's no funding for anything that we have. As musicians, that was the big issue. Yet they mentioned they took it out of the schools. They took home economics out of the schools. They're taking everything because of this financial control that care nothing for the people, but just about whoever has the most money has a seat at the table. If you don't have any money, you have to kind of get out of the game.
So, Ali, hold up. You just raised a couple of issues I want to get both John and Mara to weigh in on. Let me start with you, John, because one of the things that struck me about, you know, both of these particular issues, but as you know, we've seen over the years, a lot of times these legislative things are really, it's not code so much, but other things are going on. Do you want to respond to that?
Well, I think Holly makes a point that was made extensively yesterday during the hearing, which is a lot of the things that are being objected to now, particularly in the context of the busking activities downtown, have been around for years. It is part of the culture and the vibrancy of downtown. What's changed? Well, who lives downtown? Is what has changed. Now, as was noted earlier, downtown is replete with lots and lots of very, very expensive condos or apartment rentals. And those places are populated by a different type of demographic than we saw in the past. That's gentrification. People that lived downtown before no longer live downtown. Buskers that were downtown before are downtown now. The difference is the people listening to those buskers are different people. The neighborhood has changed. And so what we have really is a situation where somebody moves next to the airport and says, gee, you know what? You guys have to stop landing planes here because they're too loud.
They did that in New York with the tennis, actually, but that was, I think, a special case. Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that you're raising is this, you know, and I think the gentrification issue really is key. But I was also thinking, John, that a lot of times, you know, this is very convenient. And Mara, you touched on this. It's convenient way, you know, you don't like the message, you don't like the content, you don't like unions, but you can sort of undercover of this other issue, you know, oh, it's loud. Mara, do you want to talk about that?
Well, in fact, to that point, John and I worked together 10 years ago on this another round of efforts to impose noise restrictions. And at that time, it was laid bare, the illegitimacy of what was undergirding the effort. initially, the council said that they were proposing this new restrictive legislation because there were just so many complaints from people throughout the District of Columbia, from their constituencies. It was just terrible, the level of noise. There were all these problems. You know, they had to do something. This was for the betterment of the people of Washington, D.C. And they even had, as I recall, someone from the Attorney General's office, and I think then it was Corp Counsel, office came in.
That's
they
right.
were testifying
yeah.
about, I mean, testifying before the council, supporting the legislation because, again, there were so many problems, so many complaints. And so when we saw that, our organization filed a FOIA saying, okay, so give us copies of the complaints. And we forced them to disgorge all of these complaints that they had received. And we went through these one by one by one. Virtually all of the noise complaints that were being received in the District of Columbia were noise complaints over, like, HVAC units that
right.
were improperly functioning and keeping people up at night. And, you know, maybe an occasional bar or something. I don't even remember the scope, except that there weren't complaints about what the council and the Office of Attorney General were stating were the basis for this. And really what was happening is there was a strong desire to shut down labor pickets.
Mm-hmm.
That this was clearly coming from businesses and employers who did not like the daytime, lunchtime, out on the sidewalk pickets that were raising awareness about labor practices. That's what was really happening. And so with all of that material in hand, Local 25 and others just, you know, and John can speak to this, but they just went through the council and said, okay, look at this. You know, how are you going to vote now?
202-588-0893 if you've got questions or comments. You know, this we will not squelch you on this show. You have free speech on this show. But I want to just have you both talk about the broader. Mark, you started to do this earlier, right? I mean, I think that for a lot of folks, you know, when it gets into the constitutionality and so forth, you know, people's eyes glaze over. But this is, I mean, this is Washington, D.C. Like, everybody comes to D.C. to protest. I mean, it just seems so counter to what, you know, what this town is about and what this country is about. I'm really having trouble wrapping my mind around both of these issues, to be honest with you. John, let's start with you.
Well, Chris, I think you have put your finger on it. We are, like it or not, the nation's capital, as well as being a home to 700 residents. And there are many of us that feel we have a responsibility to our national status in addition to protecting the rights of local residents. So the intersection of the two issues that we're talking about today, the attempt by the National Park Service to repress use of public space, and the proposed changes to the regulations with respect to amplified free speech in the city, intersect because of the unique status of the nation's capital. People come here to express grievances against the government, and it doesn't matter whether it's a national issue or whether it's a local issue. With respect to what's being changed with the local ordinances, those will affect national efforts to come to town and to address things which are of importance on a national basis. So while many people don't like to think of our responsibility as the nation's capital, we believe that we have a responsibility to that national status, as well as protecting the rights of residents of the city to speak and be heard.
Mara, before I go to you, let's take another call. I think we have Ike as on. Ike, thanks for calling into the show.
My big brother and sisters and brothers.
Happy Friday.
Look at here, man. I've been working full time since I was 14 years young,
mm-hmm.
and I'm 65 due to math. Now, I've been fighting with management since I was that young, and I'm still fighting with management today. It's two movies that I grew up on. The Boys from Brazil, which is when they cloned Adolf Hitler, which a prime example is Nazi 45 in the White House. And The Venturian Candidate, you remember that one? It was done by Frank Sinatra, but cleaned
mm-hmm.
up by Denzel Washington and the woman. I forgot her name. Check it out, man. Things ain't changed.
I always bring in some light and some focus there. Mara, I want to get you to respond, you know, sort of on that broader level that John was just talking about the special role of D.C. But although it occurs to me, and again, I've got colleagues across the country, I mean, this is not just a D.C. issue, right?
It's not just a D.C. issue, but it is completely correct to make the point, and important to make the point, that this is the nation's capital. And when we read the First Amendment and we talk about, you know, the right to petition our government for redress of grievances, and this is the location of the White House, Congress, the Supreme Court, it is the national stage for the United States. It is where historically people come when you talk about marching on Washington. You know, we can think of so many major demonstrations that were breaking open key issues and spreading a message that went, you know, throughout the country and worldwide. And these spaces are our iconic spaces, the National Mall, the White House area, the sidewalk, Lafayette Park. We're talking about the Lincoln Memorial. We're talking about the broad sidewalks and parklands going up and down Pennsylvania Avenue. All of those are under the National Park Service control. And people come from throughout the United States to come to Washington, D.C., to have their voices heard. And any effort, whether it's from the National Park Service or the District of Columbia, to restrict Burton free speech rights, or frankly, in this new noise law proposal that will create, you know, fines and penalties and threats of arrest if people are making too much noise based on the view of one police officer, is very dangerous. And it's something that that our Constitution, that our First Amendment, simply can't tolerate. The danger is significant. And I believe if they succeed here with this National Park Service plan, which is substantial in scope, it will also become a model for other jurisdictions around the country in this view that free speech rights are somehow not central to you know, a participatory democracy, but that there's somehow some outside burden.
So hopefully we've got this on everybody's radar. Let's leave folks with what do we do? So John, let's start with you on this. There was a hearing yesterday. What's next, and what can folks do?
Well, I think most importantly, residents need to contact their council members and let them know that they wish to preserve the current law as it is, provide appropriate budgeting and funding and training to enforce the current regulations. The current law is a good law and is a law that was forged through the process of compromise and has worked. As Mara noted, this law has been in place for 10 years. So we encourage people to contact their council members and let them know they are not in favor of changes as proposed by the legislation, and that they are in favor of keeping the current regulations and law on the books.
And then, Mara, I know there's a bit of a time crunch on the PETA protests. What's the plan there?
So there's different stages. Right now, the public comment period for the regulations as proposed closes October 15th, and we need as many people as possible to take action, to go to, you can submit online comments or you can submit comments by mail. We have information on our website, which is justiceonline.org, where you can get information on how to submit public comments. It's very simple. But also there are a lot of actions that are going to be taking place, including after the October 15th period. There may be more rules that are put out. So we're urging people to come sign up with us so that they can get clear, you know, direction as to what's happening and what actions they can take, because we need as many people as possible letting the Park Service know that we won't tolerate these changes. And, it, again, the website for our organization is justiceonline.org.
And, of course, we will continue to follow it, not only on this show and on Your Rights at Work and Union City Radio, but at dclabor.org. And, guys, you know, like you, I love me a good demo. I mean, sounds to me, maybe we need to organize a loud demonstration. Is that possible? What do you think?
Protest for the right to protest.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you guys have been really generous with your time, but also most importantly, you know, just fighting, you know, this stuff just keeps popping up over the years. And so I really want to give my appreciation to both of you for the, you know, not only this fight, which we're going to keep working on, but over the years as well. Really appreciate that.
Chris, thanks for having us. And I would just also put in a plug for Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. If you haven't contributed to them, you should. They're out doing this good work every day.
Absolutely. Well said. Thanks to you both. Have a great weekend.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely. Tamara, but for Hayden Hilliard from the Partnership for Civil Justice, and you should contribute to them, and also John Borden from Unite Here Local 25. Thanks to them. We will, as I said, continue to follow this at dclabor.org. We will continue to follow it on my show.